physics. The impetus comes from the high-precision cosmology data and the progress in astrophysical observations in recent 2 or 3 years. We might need new physics to explain the observables. That is either the anomalies in the cosmic microwave background spectrum or the new data that we expect from weak cleansing at very large scales, which is why we might need to take very seriously any contender candidate to the theory of quantum gravity. Today, I will be focusing on the landscape of string theory. What are the vices and the virtues of string cosmology? Well, it does provide a well-defined framework, and there is a lot of progress being made in this field. However, one of the major problems on the last few years is that string theory does not predict one universe, just like ours, but predicts many, many solutions, probably 10 to the power 500 of them. And that has become known and has been coined by Lenny Susskind, the landscape of string theory. Initially, this was thought to be bad news. The theme over and over again in literature is, out of so many solutions, which one is ours? In which one of these vacua does our universe reside? And that has also given a boost recently and the revival to the anthropic principle. I will try to argue, I will skip the comments on the anthropic principle part, but I will try to argue that so many solutions, the landscape picture is not bad news for string theory. In fact, it is to be expected. However, there are many issues with the anthropic selection approach. And in one hand, I will try to keep an open mind to the selection principle as well. It's always good to keep an open mind to new approaches and theories, as long as we can subject those theories to the observational scrutiny, which is a very crucial point that Lee has been making over and over again. So from this approach, I don't know how the anthropic principle can be subjected to the scrutiny of observational constraints, and how we can calculate the probability distribution starting from the anthropic principle. Once we can do such a thing, then perhaps I will be convinced that that is one of the possible selection criteria from the landscape. However, I think we should have expected from the very beginning that if we were to work out the solutions from string theory, we would have ended up with many, many choices, with many, many vacua, because we expect any theory of quantum gravity to be able to address the fundamental questions about our universe, one of which is the initial conditions. How did our universe start? Why did it start at such low entropy? What provides and determines the era of time? As we all know, all these questions in cosmology seem to be observer dependent. If we have only one solution, one sample, one universe, and an observer bound to that solution, there is absolutely no hope that we can even ask such a question. Why did our universe start with those initial conditions? We need a pool of possibilities in order to even be able to ask the question, why did we end up with these initial conditions versus another possible initial condition for our universe? So the only way to ask such fundamental questions is to have a pool or a phase space of many possible universes and many possible initial conditions. So on those grounds, I think it was to be expected that solutions to string theory would end up giving us the landscape picture with many possible vacua from which only one can be ours. So to my opinion, that's not bad news, but it's rather to be expected. On a second point, we have Now, to address, fine, we have a pool of possibilities, many, many vacua, from which we can end up and choose only one. Since I commented briefly on the anthropic selection, that provided the fact that I don't know yet how an anthropic selection criteria can address the selection of the vacua in this landscape picture, that provided the motivation to try and come up with a different selection criteria. In 2004, when this landscape picture was on its first baby steps and it was emerging, I proposed that we use quantum cosmology. We place the wave function of the universe on the landscape background in order to calculate the selection of vacua on this landscape background. And namely, the way to do that is to solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So define the mini superspace in the phase space of moduli field phi that parameterizes the vacua of the landscape, and on three geometries parameterized by the scale factor A. These geometries, for example, can be the usual Friedman, Robertson, Walker geometries with flat, closed, or open universes. And in that case, the combined action of gravity plus the landscape would look something like that. I will review the formalism of quantum cosmology very briefly, and then focus more on the results. So this formalism, of course, it's got its own can of worms, and many of the issues are still debatable. However, we have got to make progress. We have got to come up with one dynamical mechanism. That's the goal, with one dynamical mechanism to calculate the probability distribution of these vacua on the landscape and address the question which one of those is the most probable one. So I won't focus on the issues and problems of quantum cosmology itself, whatever they are, but I will just take that formalism and apply it to the landscape. If I do that, then I have to solve a Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which says that the Hamiltonian of gravity plus landscape moduli phi acting on the wave function node of the universe psi is equal to zero. One of the crucial key points is that this is a timeless equation, and that will be very useful in addressing the entropy and the initial conditions question for our universe. In terms of the details, the scale A dot, derivative of the scale factor, and phi dot, the moduli field that collectively denotes the vacuum of the landscape, are promoted into operators P phi and P A, and then the Hamiltonian, based on the action I showed in the previous slide, can be written in this form. V of phi is the potential on the landscape of this modular field phi that parameterizes the vacuum. And these are the Lagrangians for the gravity part and for the moduli field part. We need one more piece of information. What is the distribution of vacuum on the landscape? What is V of phi, basically? There is a lot of work done by string theorists along those lines. Still, a lot more work needs to be done in order to have a better idea of how the landscape vacua are distributed. So at this stage, the only way to make progress is to try and model, for example, the supersymmetric sector and the non-supersymmetric sector of the landscape in such a way that it captures the essential features of these two sectors that we expect them to have. So, in order to apply the proposal of solving the Wheeler-DeWitt equation on the landscape background, I modeled the supersymmetric sector of vacua with a periodic potential type of lattice, where the array of vacua has the same structure as a lattice, and then solved the Wheeler-DeWitt equation on this type of potential. For the non-supersymmetric sector, since we expect this vacua to have all possible energies from the maximum scale in both positive and negative directions, then I model this sector with a stochastic distribution of energies for this vacua. It's a sprinkling of vacua energies.
I'm a little confused. So phi is supposed to be a modulus.
Yes.
Right? The size of the extra dimension. So for that, there is some potential mm-hmm. which people have derived. In addition, of course, what we refer to as the landscape, the different possible values of the fluxes and so on, mm-hmm. which is completely different set of fields or parameters than the modulus. Mm-hmm. So the landscape means that there are different potentials for the different values of these additional parameters. For given value of the additional parameters, you have some, you know, well-defined potential, mm-hmm. which is certainly not like that. So I am, it seems to me that you are mixing up these two.
No, so at if I understand your question correctly, at this stage, phi is the collective coordinate, which denotes the value of the vacuum, and it collectively describes all the internal degrees of freedom of that vacuum, assuming that the internal degrees of freedom of a certain vacuum have a Gaussian distribution, so they are picked around a mean center value. That mean center value is denoted by phi. At this stage, that's the picture that I'm taking just to apply this quantum cosmology framework. At a later stage, I did take into account both, not just the mean value of the vacuum denoted by phi, but also all these internal degrees of freedom that are related to how you compactify and all the fluxes and the three forms and the four forms. Basically, I use the distribution derived by Douglas and Deneuve. But considering that even if you use that distribution of vacuum, still all these internal degrees of freedom are picked around the mean value at zero order distribution that I'm supposed.
So phi is not just a modulus.
No. Okay. So then, how do we derive the selection criteria? Let's put the wave function of the universe on this landscape structure. We allow the wave function of the universe to propagate and then solve the Wheeler-Dewitt equation. From that stage on, we are simply doing quantum mechanics on the landscape. From the solutions to the Wheeler-Dewitt equation, one can calculate the probability by providing the boundary conditions, and then that probability distribution will tell us which is the most probable solution, which is the most probable wave function of the universe. That is a dynamical selection criteria and provides the most probable universe. When I applied this selection criteria to the simplified model of the supersymmetric sector of the landscape, the solutions seem to be standing waves on that sector. They are extended waves. They are not pinned around one specific vacuum. It's very similar to the theta vacuum structure and block waves. However, when applied to the non-supersymmetric sector, the solutions are localized, and the most probable solution is localized around one specific vacuum. This effect, if one thinks of the array of these vacuum as relatives, this effect, in fact, is very similar to the condensed matter analog known as the Anderson localization. If you have a lattice and you allow an electron to propagate through that lattice, and the lattice has impurities, which is very similar to the stochastic distribution of non-SUSY sector energies, then the wave function will undergo an Anderson localization, which is a very well-known effect in condensed matter physics. Basically, why this comes about is that as the wave function is trying to propagate through this stochastic structure, you have a multiple scattering of the wave function on through various sites of this lattice. Because of the stochastic distribution of energies, you will end up with a destructive interference among the phases of this multiple scattering of the wave function. This destructive interference is the one that creates the Anderson localization. And one can see the Anderson localization on this plot, where X is just a rescaled coordinate for the landscape vacuum. Alpha is the log of the scale factor on the geometry. And since the wave function depends on both the variable x of the landscape and the scale factor for the three geometries, one ends up with this kind of solution for the wave function of the universe on the non-supersymmetric sector of the landscape. Once we have the solutions, one can calculate the density of states for the solutions and show that they are picked around universes with a zero vacuum energy. So that provides the selection criteria.
What boundary condition do you choose?
In this particular case, I use the Millenkian boundary conditions. That you have outgoing modes only at time infinity, where I'm using loosely the word time to denote the intrinsic time alpha in the world of equation, which in fact is a phase space variable, it's not a real time.
Which was another boundary condition we
can. Yes, and we did play around with the Hartley-Hawking boundary conditions, and the density of state, the solution of course would look different, but once you calculate the probability distribution, you still end up with that probability being picked around the zero vacuum energy universes.
Yeah, just that, I mean, I don't think that Anderson localization, the transition from block waves to Anderson localization is like a phase transition. I don't think that details of boundary conditions are going to affect it. I mean, just imagine what's happening sort of boundary of a conductor. It's not going to change that.
But once you add impurities to the conductor, then depending on the energy at which the wave function propagates, you will get localization for all the wave functions below the maximum disorder strength.
So the question is just what determines which minimum the localization is around?
Oh, excellent. So it's the disorder strength. And in this simplified model, I took the disorder strength to be the string scale.
When you say the universe is zero vacuum energy, you have two questions. It's partly related to the last one. Mm-hmm. I mean, in this thing with white noise, I could imagine there are vacuum, essentially maybe finite, but arbitrarily large negative vacuum energy, maybe arbitrarily large positive, but I would have thought they would like to peak around the state of lowest energy, which would be
zero.
Well, but why zero? Why not arbitrarily negative?
Okay, well, I'm skipping a lot of details here because even the calculation itself is done by using random matrix theory methods. But if you use the all the negative vacuum energy solutions are actually cut out of the physically relevant solutions because you do not get, you don't give birth to a universe in terms of the variable alpha. Instead of getting an oscillatory solution,
so
with
decaying.
Respect to alpha, you get a decaying solution.
Okay, so then when you say the universe with zero, I mean, there's lots of them, right? There'll be lots of zero or near zero vacuum states. So do you mean some superposition over all of those things, or do you mean one particular one is singled out?
No, a superposition of all of those. You have a clustering around all the zero.
One of the augmentation boundary minimum condition questions is that the wave function doesn't depend on time. It's not dynamic. So how do you describe the expanding universe?
So alpha plays the role of the intrinsic time. And I wanted the formalism that is timeless in order to address the initial conditions issue. So that's a good thing, it's not a bad thing. But at this stage, the solutions to lower the weak equations are just giving birth to a particular universe. Once you have that solution, then you do define time as a derivative of the action by the usual methods. And that time is defined in such a way that it does agree with the time that appears on the zero-zero component of Einstein equation, on the Friedmann equation. So from that point onwards, once you invert the universe, then you do define your time working. Okay, so that was just the first stage of applying that formalism to see what kind of selection will give for the supersymmetric and the non-supersymmetric sector. But we still would like to address the important questions, which is, what are the initial conditions of the universe and how are they related to the era of time? Is there any implication between a late time fundamental cosmological constant and early time inflation, as is often discussed in literature in terms of holography? Basically, does the late time acceleration put a bound on early time physics on our universe? What is the relation between gravity, quantum, and the thermodynamics, specifically the second law of thermodynamics? In order to at least get a warm-up exercise, Rich Holman and I started thinking of this landscape vacuum as the phase space for the initial conditions of the universe. Basically, each vacuum is a possible one that can give rise to a universe like ours. Therefore, I can think of the collection of vacuum that make up the landscape as the phase space of the initial conditions, as the multiverse. From that point onwards, we can ask the question, then, how were the initial conditions for our universe were picked up? That will also allow us to talk in terms of the super observers and universe-bound local observers. As I mentioned at the beginning, if we have only one universe to play with and an observer boundary, and all our answers are observer-dependent, then we cannot even ask the question, how were the initial conditions of our universe picked up? Or why do we have the era of time that we have? We need a pool of possibilities in order to ask that question, because that question immediately begs the second stage. The initial conditions for our universe as compared to what? To what else? So that's why, having a landscape with many possibilities, I have a possibility to answer the question, as compared to what? That's why I think the landscape picture is good news, actually, and it needs to be expected of any candidate of quantum gravity theories. And once you buy this picture, that the landscape is the phase space of the initial conditions, is the multiverse, it's a physical background that provides the old dream of a multiverse picture, then, of course, we have to address all the other issues that come with it. How did our past become here from the rest? Is there any traces of the entanglement between different solutions, between different patches at early times? And what was there before time? And that's what I will focus on. We need a continuous measurement. And for that, as discussed by many people, including Kiefer and Starobinsky and Hartle, Hawking, Holywell, many, many people, the literature is very rich. I will be using the higher multiples with wavelengths larger than the horizon size. Basically, in the initial picture of the Willard-DeWitt equation for three geometries, Friedmann-Robertson-Walker geometries, and the modular field phi, I will be perturbing the metric by an epsilon ij and perturb the moduli field in order to include the internal and the external degrees of freedom of this vacuum in the landscape, and try to solve a master equation instead of the Willard-DeWitt equation. The reason for doing so, for going into such trouble, is the hope that the back reaction of these perturbation modes, especially of the massive Skinner field mode phi, on the geometry will provide the decoherence mechanism. This calculation of to quadratic order of the perturbation modes for phi and for the three metric epsilon and j was done a long time ago by, just to mention one paper, by Howell and Hawking. So I did use the results in terms of the calculation of the quadratic order of epsilon ij and this spherical harmonics FQN. But the new thing here is that once you have these perturbations to quadratic order, then you feed it back. Their contribution, Hn, is fed back as a back reaction term on the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Therefore, we end up with a Maxwell equation, where the Hamiltonian of gravity plus phi acting on the wave function of the universe is not equal to zero anymore, but is equal to these quadratic terms that come from the perturbations of long wavelength modes.
So that angle bracket you're tracing over the fluctuations that you're not following?
Yeah. So the, in that case, the quadratic order, assuming that most modes except the ones that are longer than the horizon scale are in the adiabatic ground state, then the wave function of the universe, which now is not a function of scale factor alpha and moduli field phi, but also of an infinite number of perturbations, is given approximately by the zero order wave functional times a product over n, over the perturbations n, of psi n alpha fn. Fn denotes collectively the perturbations for the massive modes.
But the angle bracket, are you taking an excitation value over part of the Hilbert space so that the capital psi in your in that equation there is not spanning the whole Hilbert space? You say not your equation, I'm thinking that. Mm-hmm. Are you getting decoherence at this point by tracing something?
Yes, I will be tracing over the time.
But you haven't done it yet?
No.
Okay. So, Laura, can you say, I mean, just in words, what you're doing is you're taking your quantum system to be the radius of the universe as a whole and the homogeneous value of the scalar field or added value of the scalar field as a whole, and you're taking the environment to be the fluctuations of finite wavelength.
Exactly.
And you're tracing over the environment and you're getting an equation for the so how come it's still a wave function equation rather than a density matrix? I mean, if you have a quantum system with different degrees of freedom, mm-hmm. and you trace over some of the degrees of freedom, you get a density matrix for the remaining degrees of freedom.
Which is the ultimate goal. That is the next step.
She didn't trace it. She said that was my question.
Yeah. So once I trace over Fn, the perturbation modes, I will calculate the density matrix by psi squared. But the perturbation modes for the massive field will include both, because phi is the landscape coordinate. So it will have internal degrees of freedom, and I'm looking at those as perturbations around the mean value of phi, and also external degrees of freedom. So Fn, the perturbation, long wavelength perturbation modes for the massive field, are in fact representing the internal and external degrees of freedom for the landscape back here.
So what's the background geometry here again?
FRW. Yeah, 3. And basically, I just want to know the effect of these massive landscape modes on the background geometry and find out what it does.
And in terms of, I mean, you keep talking about the landscape, but basically you're doing quantum, what you mean when you say you're doing the landscape is you're doing quantum cosmology, and you're just assuming that there happens to be one scalar field which has a potential, which is a random, rough, complex potential.
Yeah.
For a set of scalar fields.
At this stage, so at the first stage for finding psi naught, I found, I used that simplified model of just the stochastic distribution of vacuum. But at this stage, the potential I'm using for the landscape is the one advocated by Douglas and Dunant. That includes both internal and external degrees of freedom.
I don't know what you mean when you say internal and external. So
each vacuum at some, say, phi 1 or phi 2 or phi n, will not have only phi as its coordinate that labels that vacuum, but in fact will be a collection of many vacuum peaked around that mean value. There are many internal degrees of freedom inside that vacuum, depending on how you compactify the theory. So the mean value has many resonances of a moduli field peaked around it.
So there are many scalar, so if I understand, there are many scalar fields to label the vacuum.
Yeah.
And treating one of them as an average value and or something like that.
Yeah, and including, so the vacuum itself is very rich in structure, forgetting that there are 10 to the power 500 vacuum. We're just focusing on one vacuum.
But what was confusing me is there's a big difference between an extremization problem on a high dimensional space and an extremization problem on a one dimensional space.
So at this stage, I'm looking at the infinite dimensional space. The mini superspace has become of infinite dimension.
No, no, but in terms of the number of scalar fields which label the vacuum, you're idealizing that there's an infinite number.
Yes.
No. And I thought we have only just the single coordinate to classify
on. That was the coordinate phi. At this stage, the mini superspace includes this perturbation massive mode Fn, where n runs from 0 to infinity. So the mini superspace has become of infinite dimension.
Right, that's just sure. But is the assumption that the landscape of possible vacua is a one-dimensional space or a high dimensional space?
A higher dimensional space at this stage.
And we keep interrupting. The landscape has effectively an infinite number of solutions. Vacuum. Tends to find how we treat as a fluid. So people often say the general answer is there's an infinite number of solutions. And very large number. The difference is that you take Einstein's field equations, the fourth equations, and you solve them. Mm-hmm. And put in, you take the solar system, you solve the striker symmetric static solution. You impose the boundary condition, you have asymptotic flatness infinity, and out comes a unique solution. Mm-hmm. And you solve the unique solution compared to the solar system data that we could increase remarkably well. Now, the problem with string theory is that you have an infinite number of solutions, but until now you don't have an equation that controls them, like TR. So you can't sit down and solve an equation. Cause of boundary conditions and get a unique answer, for example, of the vacuum state.
Why not?
You don't. You don't have an equation which you can solve and get a unique answer for the vacuum. This is the whole problem.
So
people adopt the negative point of view that in order to solve, to save the theory, so if you can get the petition, you introduce the anthropic principle and the multi-verses. And you end up, according to these people, without any prediction. Because you can't have a prediction on the basis of an infinite number of units.
So that's an alternative. This one is an alternative approach to the anthropic principle. And you allow the wave function of the universe to propagate on this mini superspace, which is defined by the vacuum variable phi by the infinite number of perturbations fn and by the three geometry scale factor frw. You solve this master equation. You can calculate the probability in a similar manner to the probability distribution in a similar manner to quantum mechanics. So from that point, you can talk about the most probable solution.
Just
for our universe.
It's a statistical solution.
Yes.
It's not a solution in the sense of general relativity.
But at that stage, once you have that most probable solution, you define your time variable as the derivative of the action with respect to the mini superspace variables. So that time parameter, t, is defined in such a way that it does agree with the time of the Einstein-Friedman equation. From that point, It has been shown, for example, by Klaus Kiefer, that this approach is equivalent to the 10 Einstein equations. So everything else follows through from that point onwards. Okay, so now that I have the master equation, the physics is contained of what I'm about to focus on, is contained on this back reaction term U of alpha phi times Fn squared, where Fn are the massive perturbation modes. One can calculate the effect, the back reaction term, for the metric modes. However, it has been shown a long time ago that due to the constraints from the CMB, these perturbation modes, tensor, for example, gravity wave perturbation modes, are at least 5 orders of magnitude less than the zero order term. So I already know that their back reaction is going to be small. They will not help me much for what I am after. That's why I will focus on the massive perturbation modes, since they are in their non-adiabatic states and they can be quite powerful. Therefore, their back reaction on the free geometry can have a significant effect.
Sorry, here's another interruption again. I mean, we know they're small, but we only know they're small at the part of the universe we can observe. So if the idea is to look over this large sector, why should we assume they're small?
Okay, so. In any sector, you know that at least the quadratic order, the metric perturbation modes are in their ground state. But the massive perturbation modes are roughly, their strength is roughly multiplied by the inflaton squared, and they are in their non-adiabatic state. So you already know that the strength of the massive modes is higher than the metric modes.
Everywhere and all possible vacuum.
Yeah, for any inflaton. So if you focus on the sector of the landscape that contains inflationary cosmologies, in any of them, the massive mode will be as an order of magnitude, it will be the order of the metric mode times the inflaton phi. That's the reason why they are non-adiabatic. So
it's just even stops my time, let me ask. So I'm worried about the approximations here, because Richard and I did a similar calculation involving deep Hungarian modes, and what I heard you say earlier on was that the short wavelength modes are going to be the ones that deep Hungarian the mini superspace fields that we're following. Right? But those are the issue becomes how short is short. And so you're now saying that these modes are not in the radiative vacuum. So we're thinking now of modes that are long wavelength compared to the Hubble scale, right? Mm-hmm. So in the master equation formulation, normally there's an approximation that gets made in these stochastic calculations where the assumption is that the stochastic time scale is really short compared to the one you're interested in following, right? And the one we're interested in following in this case is the Hubble scale itself. So my worry is that if you're tracing over modes that are not in the vacuum, as though the ones that you're tracing over are ones whose time scale is not short, it's comparable to the scale that you're trying to follow. So there's a question of whether or not you're calculating, you lose control of it.
No, but that would be based on the intuition of the 3+1 effective theory. At this stage, there is no time yet. This is a tendency equation.
Well, so I'm thinking of going back to your Anderson localization thing, that the basic statement that the trace over of the other degrees of freedom that you're hearing modes that you're trying to follow, normally the way you actually the issue will be how do you calculate your mass equation and do you do it in perturbation theory? And then essentially the issue will be the energy scale involved in your coupling is being compared to a time. And if you believe your solution beyond perturbation theory, then something has to be adjusted. Mm-hmm.
So once you have a continuous measurement by higher multiples, and that's something, it's a very good question that Kiefer spent a lot of time studying, then you want to make sure that in the act of measurement, your system is not being disturbed by the environment. And the environment over which you trace over are these FN massive perturbation modes. Now, if you focus on the coupling strength of these higher multiples to your system is in fact very, very small. It's just gravitational coupling. So the system has not really been disturbed by the environment which is doing the act of measurement.
Well, it's not just disturbance, it's correlation, because by setting up the master equation, what you're essentially doing is you're saying that the derivative of the density matrix is being determined in terms of what's happening to the density matrix now, and you don't care about the history of the correlation. And that's an assumption that the correlation times are short in the environment that you traced over. And that's what's suspect if you have, if it's a relative time scale, which is the time scale. But let me come back, I'll ask Pat once you mention back, you told us how you calculate the master plan.
Okay. So, the back reaction term is given by U, some potentially looking term, which is a function of A and phi times the mode, the perturbation mode squared. This U of alpha and phi is a function of Y. Y is being determined as the derivative of the action with respect to the mini superspace variables, with respect to alpha and to phi. During inflation, this factor y is roughly given by 3 phi, I think, level. At the end of inflation, y becomes very large. During the coherent oscillations of the inflaton phi I, this still phi becomes the inflaton on the reduced three-dimensional picture. So at the end of inflation, at the exit of inflation, because of the coherent oscillations, this factor y is very, very large, which means that the last two terms on the back reaction term drop out, and only you are left with only the first two terms. But during inflation, because the action is nothing more than 3 phi squared times the scale factor q, then the y term is considerable. It's 3 times phi I. So replacing this value for y, one can show that during inflation, in fact, the back reaction term can become negative. And that can give rise to instabilities in the master equation. So for u negative, solving the master equation, the wave functional will contain unstable modes, tachyonic modes, where mu n here squared, I just defined an effective mass square term as a back reaction u times x squared. So if the back reaction term becomes negative, then that's equivalent to having a tachyonic mode in your wave functional. Once you have a tachyonic mode into your wave function of the universe, then of course that will not give birth to a universe. So these solutions should be excluded from the physically relevant solutions that one can obtain for 3+1 dimensional universes from the landscape. In real space-time, by doing the following the usual procedure of quantum cosmology and defining a time variable in terms of the action, then one can study what happens to these massive perturbation modes in real space-time, not in the mini-superspace. And it can be shown that some of these very long wavelength massive perturbation modes can, in fact, grow without bound instead of being frozen up. What are the conditions that these two bad things occur? That the wave functional collapses due to a tachyonic instability, and the massive perturbations for that wave function grow without bound, therefore their back reaction destroys the inflationary geometry. Basically, when do we have U negative for inflationary cosmologies? And the conditions that can be easily found from this form of the master equation and the back reaction term are such that when the mass of that inflaton, which is just the second derivative of the vacuum potential, is larger than the Hubble scale of that solution, and the inflaton phi is less than 1 in fundamental units, then that patch collapses. It undergoes this tachyonic instability and therefore is physically irrelevant. It is only patches with a mass of the inflaton less than the Hubble scale and an inflaton that starts high up in the potential that can survive and grow and therefore become a physically irrelevant universe. From the solutions to the wave function of the universe, one of course can calculate the density matrix and show that there is some Gaussian width for the non-diagonal terms, for the cross-correlation terms. Finding the commutator of the Hamiltonian with a density matrix, it is straightforward to show that, in fact, it's not equal to zero. It can be seen even here. Since from all the possible points in phase space, which is this mini superspace of initial conditions, some of those points in the phase space become physically irrelevant because those universe solutions collapse. And some of them are physically relevant only for the universes that survive this growth, then it can be shown that the phase space is actually shrinking. It's being compressed. That is the reason why the calculation of the commutator of the density matrix with the Hamiltonian is not equal to zero.
Right.
The phase space is not conserved. Yes?
I mean, your argument, I mean, that some parts of the phase space are shrinking is kind of, I think, evident, but I mean, first of all, your phase space would also consist of momentum states, conjugate momentum relative to phi. Is it physically clear why the total phase space should be shrinking?
So the conjugate momentum were, in fact, the operators pa and p phi that I defined in the second slide.
Right.
And yes, you can go in both pictures, either in terms of the variables or in terms of momentum.
So
in both,
you have the volume of this phase space, or you do that?
And you will have the non-diagonal term in the density matrix be non-zero in both, in momentum or in the variable itself. And of course, if you think of the analogy with the Gaussian packet, and the uncertainty principle, because this is nothing more than quantum mechanics on the landscape, then the Gaussian width in terms of alpha and phi, when you go to the momentum picture, that Gaussian width is the inverse. So what's happening is that as the wave function propagates, the Gaussian width wave path will start spreading out in one variable, and if you go to the other variable, because of the uncertainty principle, it will be a squeezed state. What's interesting is that we showed that phase space is not conserved, the phase space of the initial conditions, because of this dynamical mechanism. The back reaction on the geometry from the massive modes is such that some of the initial de Sitter universes will collapse under the influence of that back reaction of the massive modes. Some of the inflationary cosmologies will survive that reaction and therefore continue to grow and give birth to Friedman others on the Walker universe. So that was done by doing this kind of quantum cosmology calculation and including the impact of the back reaction. By a totally different approach, at the same time that Rich and I were doing this calculation, Rafael Busso was using GR arguments and showed the exact same thing. And the same reason why the phase space is not conserved once you include the back reaction of the massive modes. And the conditions that...
Before you leave that previous slide, rows that you're writing in the bottom there is now the density matrix for the mini superspace variables, right?
By tracing out the higher multiples.
And you haven't shown us the master equation, but from the solution, I can guess that mu is a measure of the coupling between the mini superspace variable and the other variables you traced out. And it looks like what's happened is you've taken a solution where you're working non-perturbatively in mu. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm coming back to the issue of the what controls the approximation, because the
mu is this one.
Right, which is the potential, and that's the coupling between the sectors that are equal to each other. And so when the master equation, you didn't write the master equation, so I can't be completely sure, but I suspect that the master equation you wrote down, the term that was decohering in the density matrix was computed perturbatively in mu, because that's the only tool you really have. And so then there's an issue of the consistency of the calculation, because you've integrated an equation which you derived to linear order, some leading order of mu, and then you're taking the solution to all orders of mu.
Mm-hmm.
And in kinetic time physics, that can be justified, but it relies on the separation of scales, that the correlation time is extremely short compared to the times you're following.
Mm-hmm.
And in the calculation you're doing, it sounds like you don't have that separation of scales, because the things you're tracing out had a time except for the Hubble scale, and the things you're following also have time except for the Hubble scale, so there's no clean separation of scales.
No, because the time scale is the inverse of that coupling strand that I was talking about. The coupling between the higher multiples 3 geometry is roughly gm over r, where g is Newton's constant, mass, m will be the mass of this perturbation mode, and r is roughly the wavelength, which is of the order horizon and higher. You can show that that coupling strength is extremely small, which is the reason why they the I higher multiples small. Are very good.
That's not the relevant thing, though. I agree that it's small, so that would justify calculating your mass equation perturbatively. But then you can ask in your exponential and your solution, even though mu is small, you're going to trick that solution when the dimensionless thing in the exponent is not small.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be justifiable if you had the separation of scales. But because you're relying on the states that you're tracing out not being in their adiabatic vacuum, you force yourself to be looking at states who are long wavelength compared to the couple scale. And that's the scale which is describing the time interest, the time evolution that you're trying to follow. So I think there's an issue here as to whether or not you can really trust that final line, even though mu is extremely small.
So which are the scales you are comparing?
Well, normally the things you'd be comparing would be the correlation. So you've got some fluctuation. Essentially, it's a mean field expansion is what the coherence is. And so what counts is the correlation time of the states that you, whatever the states were you traced over. And you want that to be short compared to the time evolution that you're trying to follow in the density matrix for the for the quantum variable that you're following. And so that's the hierarchy that you have to maintain. And so it's not clear that why that should be justified in this case.
So your question is how does mu relate to h? Since h will give you the time scale inverse of the Hubble.
No, it's stronger than that. So the question is why should I trust? So the precise question would be, I believe that you can calculate this mass equation perturbatively in mu because mu is very small. But why am I not also now forced to only believe the solution to linear order in mu as well? So I shouldn't really believe the exponential form. I should say it's really 1 plus mu to the fourth times something. To really believe the whole solution, you have to rely on something else to justify integrating the equation beyond perturbation theory in the interaction.
Maybe you should discuss that after, but I'm not sure I'm calling it the next.
Okay, I'm going to have to do that.
Okay, so trying to figure out the physical interpretation of that result. Why are the non-diagonal terms of the density matrix not zero? And why the phase space is shrinking? Why do some of these inflationary patches collapse under the back reaction effect of the massive modes and some of them survive? Well, the entropy of those initial patches is nothing more than the Euclidean action. We already have a form of the Euclidean action from the solutions. Basically, the wave function solution is nothing more to this saddle point approximation than the exponential of the action. So we do have the wave function of the universe, therefore we have an expression, a very complicated expression, for the action and therefore for the entropy of those patches. Roughly, it can be shown that this Euclidean action, which is the entropy, goes roughly as Ri minus RFn squared, where Ri would be the radius of the Hubble patch before you include the back reaction term, and RFn is given in terms of this back reaction term. Physically, this term is suspiciously very much like a black hole correction to the entropy for Schwarzschild the Sitter geometries. If you think of putting all these massive perturbation modes inside the black hole, then one can talk about the Schwarzschild the Sitter geometry and the horizon scale of the black hole versus the horizon scale of the Sitter space-time, and therefore talk about the corrections to the entropy coming from the combined system of the Sitter and black hole modes. In fact, these massive modes have not really collapsed into a black hole yet, but just to get a very rough idea, one can think of them, of the contribution from all of them as making up one black hole with this kind of radius. So, what is happening here is that when the energy scale of the black hole is higher than the energy scale of inflation of the Sitter geometry, those initial patches will collapse. They will not give birth to the universe. Those were the previous conditions that we obtained from the calculation. These pseudo geometries that started at a low energy scale will not survive the collapse, the back reaction of this black hole mode. But all the pseudo geometries where the energy scale of the pseudo geometry is higher than the energy scale of the black hole, they can survive the collapse. Since we can talk about horizon sizes and the energy scales being inverse of each other. So you can either think of the geometrical picture where the black hole is inside the sphere or outside the sphere and compare their horizons, or you can think on in terms of geometries of the black hole and the sphere space and then compare both and find out when the back reaction from these massive modes is stronger that can make the sphere collapse or otherwise. The bottom line is that it is only the universes that survive this back reaction, this collapse. It's only them that they become physically relevant and give birth to a universe at later times. All the other ones, the ones that undergo collapse, will not be physically relevant points in phase space. So ergodicity is explicitly broad. What that means is that we should be very, very careful in using kernel statistical arguments when asking questions about the entropy, the initial conditions, the effect of a late time cosmological constant into the early time physics and so on. Until now, the argument that the problem with initial conditions has been that the probability of an inflationary patch goes as exponential of the entropy, and the entropy is inverse of the cosmological constant. That right away disfavors all high energy scale inflation. But this whole argument of the probability going as the exponential of the entropy is based on thermal statistical arguments. What this calculation shows, especially the fact that the phase space is not conserved, what that shows is that we do not have a statistical equilibrium when you take into account gravitational degrees of freedom. So at a deeper level, that would be the physical interpretation. If you apply these arguments for black holes only, for matter degrees of freedom, fine. The tendency towards equilibrium of matter degrees of freedom is such that it comes in, it collapses into a black hole. But the tendency of gravitational degrees of freedom is such that it blows out, it expands out. In fact, gravity is a negative heat capacity system. So naively, if one tried to use the second law of thermodynamics to gravitational degrees of freedom, it would mean that that heat flows from cold to hot systems. What we have considered here and the calculation is based on a combined system, gravity plus matter. Gravitational degrees of freedom plus matter degrees of freedom. As the gravitational degrees of freedom are trying to expand out to use their tendency towards equilibrium, matter degrees of freedom are trying to collapse in order to go towards equilibrium. When you have the combination of both, this fight of opposite effects is such that the system is not in equilibrium. It's far out, in fact, of equilibrium. That is why using statistical arguments that are heavily based in assuming equilibrium for your combined system leads to paradoxes. Instead, in order to address the issue of the initial conditions and other important issues for the early universe, we should be using out of equilibrium methods rather than statistical methods in order to address those issues. It's in analogy, it's very, very similar to Boltzmann kinetic equation. If you have some collision between particles, you better include that collision term because it's an out of equilibrium phenomena. You cannot use canonical ensembles or statistical mechanics. By definition, stat math is based on the assumption of equilibrium. So we can't assume ergodicity and statistical mechanics calculations in order to address these important issues. I believe that that's where those paradoxes stem from when we try to use arguments that probability is exponential of the entropy, etc., and we end up with paradoxes. Instead, we should be using out of equilibrium calculations to address these issues. when gravity is concerned, when gravitational degrees of freedom enter into the picture. And in that case, we have to calculate things with out of equilibrium methods. If we do that, as this is one example, using out of equilibrium calculations, then we find out that the selection of the initial conditions for the universe, applied in this case to a landscape picture as the phase space of the initial conditions, we find out that only inflationary patches that start at very high energy scale are the ones that will survive the back reaction, the collapse. Inflationary patches that start at very low energy scale, where the inflaton is very close to its depth, to the bottom of the well, those do not survive collapse if they are not physically relevant. So that explains why we should expect the initial conditions of our universe to start at a very high energy scale of inflation, because it's only those bubbles that will survive the back reaction of the long wavelength massive moments. And that's also good news for the era of time. In order to have an era of time pointing towards the future, then as Penrose has argued, then we have to expect that our universe started at a very low entropy, lower than what it is today. And in this case, the entropy is at its lowest when the back reaction term is almost equal to the entropy of the gravitational degrees of freedom of the Sitter spacetime. The entropy is nearly zero there. That is the condition where the first inflationary patch will survive the collapse. All the inflationary patches that are below this back reaction strength, they will collapse and just be wiped out of phase space. The inflationary patches that are above this scale will grow and therefore give birth to universes. The borderline is the ones where the back reaction term is almost of the same strength as the De Sitter space. But those have a nearly zero entropy. They have the lowest entropy possible. And they are the ones that can give rise to a universe that will continue to exist, that becomes physically relevant. So, to conclude, the landscape is reaching phenomenology. The top-down approach will be to really explore the structure. That the structure of the Bakhtiar distribution is not very well known yet. There is a lot of work being done, and maybe in a few years we will have a much better idea on how Bakhtiar are distributed. But that will also be very helpful to apply this kind of mechanisms in order to address fundamental issues in cosmology. The bottom-up approach in this scenario is to use the quantum cosmology framework with all its vices and virtues just to make some progress, to have a dynamical selection of the vacuum for our universe, and then do the calculations for the initial conditions or for the cosmological constant. The coherence is addressed from the quantum mechanical solutions by tracing out this higher multiple degrees of freedom. And finally, how general is this approach? If I don't believe in the landscape and I will try to use that to another quantum gravity theory, will everything go through? Will this argument talked about gravitational degrees of freedom having an opposite tendency towards equilibrium and therefore a combination of matter plus gravity system being a completely out of equilibrium system? I believe that, and I might be wrong on this, time will tell, but I believe that any kind of quantum gravity theory will end up providing for us a discrete structural vacuum, a pool of possibilities from which we can ask the question, which one out of so many possibilities provided the initial conditions for our universe? By having, and I can't emphasize this point enough, if there is a theory that provides only one possibility, then I cannot possibly ask the question, why did the initial conditions ended up being the ones that we know they were? Because it's always the question, why did I pick up these initial conditions, always leads to the second stage as compared to what else. So it might be possible that this landscape structure string theory might be a more generic feature of any theory of quantum gravity, in which case we can study carefully and answer the issue of the choice of the initial conditions, the entropy and the error of time. Work in progress is to try and add more degrees of freedom to this landscape structure by putting standard model degree of freedom into the vacuum and see if there is any kind of scaling between the hierarchies in nature through some critical phenomena or whatever. Thank you.
I think at this stage of physics, we're all sitting wondering what's going to happen. Because there's a big argument going on with the landscape, such and so on. And there are those people who are appalled by the multiverse. So the bottom line question is, can string theory of this kind of approach produce a prediction that can be tested observation? Because this is how we do physics.
Absolutely.
We lose falsifiability and testability. We've lost science, okay? So it's not clear at all that this is the case. I mean, a lot of people feel that it's improbable after 20, 25 years. Mm-hmm. The best minds of physics working on string theory. That with the present situation, we will be able to produce a prediction. For example, which vacuum fits the standard model of physics? How do we calculate the tiny size of the cosmological cost from a given vacuum? And how do you expect this picture to produce a specific result?
That's an excellent question, because that's what has been worrying me for a while. So, okay, great, suppose I buy the whole thing here, but then how can I tell? Do I have any kind of observational signature? We are working on this now, and the hope is that perhaps some of this quantum entanglement, you know, the number avenue terms in the density matrix, maybe some of that entanglement between different patches might have survived and can show up later on in CMB perturbations or dark scale structure. It might be re-entering just now. But we haven't done the calculation yet, so I don't know even if it has survived, what order of magnitude we're talking about, and can it be observed or not. But the only way I can see this picture at the moment to find any kind of observational signature is to look for this quantum entanglement. Scale pattern, gravity decoheres right away. That's of course to be expected, but the massive modes might still have some entanglement left.
So I think I feel that I can be easily convinced that if you're talking about the early universe, it is not an equilibrium system, and so one way that you can consider what's going on is gravity and matter. But I have a bit of confusion of the order of things. If we're talking about a fundamental theory, such as string theory or quantum gravity, then gravity is also supposed to arise at a certain point. So if you also think that gravity is an effective theory, in what order do things happen? So do I have this unusual system from the very beginning that competes with matter, but it's not really gravity, gravity arises, or does gravity arise first from a more fundamental theory and then have
an
equilibrium system still?
Yeah, that's a very good question. In the approach taken, in the more general setting, I don't know. But in the approach taken here, gravity is taken as the more fundamental theory, and then the matter modes are just perturbations on top of that system.
Okay, so that's what you have.
And the reason why I think this approach here is because the scale factor, the gravitational degree of freedom, decoheres first from the rest. So.
I agree with all the words, but I have a lot of technical issues to the course of it. So one of them is the age, if I understand right, the age which in the end you're referring to, which says the age doesn't commute with the density matrix, is that the age which was the Hamiltonian constraint of the full theory or some effective Hamiltonian?
That's the age that includes the back reaction in the master equation.
Okay, but again, I'm confused by saying thing that Fontinius. Underlying, I mean, something in common with your treatment and almost every discussion of the landscape is there's an assumption that somewhere there's some underlying theory, which is actually never discussed, never mentioned.
Absolutely.
And the quote landscape, the idea that there is a bunch of scalar fields and the potential for those bunch of scalar fields, which come from moduli fields of string theory, is presumably an effective or approximate description of that more fundamental theory.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay. If that more fundamental theory is the quantum theory of space-time, then possibly, I mean, there are people who disagree, but possibly the Hamiltonian is a constraint, and then should commute with all physical observables. So the Hamiltonian, I think what you're saying is that, I mean, if I translate the words, you're saying something like, okay, out of equilibrium, the theorem that I'm sorry, I was going to say something about, okay. You want to say that out of equilibrium, you don't have a canonical ensemble.
Yeah.
Okay. But there still is, in terms of some fundamental degrees of freedom, a grand partition function, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back to those fundamental degrees of freedom, then probability has to be conserved, and classically the phase space probability distribution has to be conserved. The volume of phase space has to be conserved. You want to say that the probability distribution is collapsing on small sets of phase space, but that's not the same thing as saying that the volume of phase space is not conserved. At least I'm confused by that.
So, in this case, the phase space is this linear superspace. And since some of the points are excluded, then if you start from one point on phase space, picking one particular solution or one system, and then let that follow the trajectory of that point and wait an infinitely long time. And even here, I'm being very careful since this is a timeless kind of formalism. But the phase space volume is not conserved, and that point will never come back close enough to itself.
Because you don't have ergodicity.
Yeah.
But even without ergodicity, probability is conserved.
Yeah.
So there's some more fundamental description.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, and on unitarity grounds as well. At a defective theory level, then this is the kind of coarse-grained approach. But if I knew what the fundamental theory is, then it would be a totally different story. So yeah, one can think of this as the first grain in effect.
Well, I think the effective Hamiltonian to start with is not string theory anymore. Nobody knows what the real Hamiltonian string theory is.
Sure.
It is some low energy effective description to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So you have integrated out all the upstream modes, all the brains, and et cetera, et cetera. And that's why, I mean, to come back to this other question, that's why I really don't think you can, you know, be populating different or comparing different points on the landscape, because these things they are transitions between them, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
but they are spring scale effects, like, you know, brain creation processes and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you are describing a potential for a modulus.
Mm-hmm.
And that is certainly not a random potential. I mean, you for a given set of fluxes, the given non-perturbative term, and so on, you have some kind of moon potential. And the landscape really describes different potentials where you are changing the fluxes, changing the non-perturbative terms, and so on. And those are springy processes, which really there is no very good description of that. I mean, one can sort of give an effective description in terms of brain creation. But it's not clear what the initial the fundamental Hamiltonian is, and B, what this huge potential, I mean, the potential in the on the landscape is. Right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the top-down approach. I think it's fair to say that at this stage, nobody knows yet or understands yet the structure of the landscape.
Sure.
So in order to illustrate this dynamical mechanism and just move ahead, not wait until somebody tells me what that distribution of acne on the landscape is, I use either the very simplified picture of the stochastic distribution of acne parameterized by time, and that approach just totally ignores internal degrees of freedom on each vacuum. But then for the second stage, to try and get a bit closer to a real string landscape, I use the Douglas and the Neff distribution of vacuum, which is, in fact, it's very similar, that distribution of vacuum that they estimate in terms of the Susi breaking scale, and they do include internal degrees of freedom for each vacuum as well, which comes from the different configurations and all these brain annihilation processes. But in that distribution, you have a very close analogy, as Douglas has pointed out, with universality C classes of quantum dots. So these were the two. I didn't use, for example, the Busa-Polchinski type of vacuum distribution, which is another type that people are playing with for the landscape.
But that's a that is a distribution of vacuum, of minima of these different potentials. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that can be described by a scalar field as the way you are describing. Yeah, I mean, that's not described in terms of a modulus. Mm-hmm. I mean, modulus refers to the potential at any point, I mean, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's it's a low energy description. Mm-hmm. It's a four dimensional low energy description. Given a particular point on the landscape, you have some effective four dimensional description. Mm-hmm. And so it's not clear to me that you can, mix these two things up.
So phi, one can think of phi as a collective coordinate. And in order to make sense of collective coordinates, you expect some kind of Gaussian distribution. I don't know, these are your vacuum of the landscape, and you also have an internal space with many, many degrees of freedom, probably even more than the external ones. If the resonances, the multiply resonances, are closely spaced to some mean values, then I can consider that mean value to be my phi, my collective coordinate. So phi is just a collective coordinate that labels a particular vacuum. Now, how can we possibly label the vacuum in this landscape? We know there are vacuums, 10 to the power 500 of them, but how can I label them? The way we have done it here is through collective coordinates, hoping that all the internal degrees of freedom are somehow picked around that collective coordinate. Same thing here. Whatever the internal space is, these resonances, these internal degrees of freedom, are picked around some value, say phi 2. So phi is just a label, collective coordinate that denotes the vacuum. But around phi, you have many, many resonances, many modes.